This is the first in a series of four Jubilee Centre talks given by Dr. Roy Clements at the Westminster Cathedral Hall in London. The talk is entitled Windows on the World, the Contemporary Message of Popular Culture, and is introduced by Dr. Michael Schlitter, Director of the Jubilee Centre.
Introducing Roy is always a slightly complex matter as far as I'm concerned, because I'm never quite sure which of the many facets of his career to mention. But I'd like to mention just two or three. I first met Roy in Nairobi when he was pastor at Nairobi Baptist Church, and it's a particular pleasure for us to have two or three Kenyans, in fact three Kenyans, not two or three, three Kenyans here with us tonight, one of whom's a friend who was in that congregation in Kenya at the time we were both there. So it's very special to have him, and also one of the leading political figures in Kenya tonight. So thank you very much for coming and joining us. We're delighted to see you here. It's our privilege to have you. Thank you. Roy did a PhD in physical chemistry, which means that he knows quite a lot about science and different areas of science. He taught me an enormous amount about politics and sociology, and also even about economics, which is my own background. So he is somebody with a very wide academic interest and background, as I think you'll probably gather from these four talks that he's going to give. He came back to Cambridge in 1978-79, and has been based in Cambridge ever since, although he does travel the world very widely speaking. He's doing these four talks on the issue of culture. We'll be looking particularly at the theme of relationships, which will run through the four talks. Tonight the subject is Windows on the World, and we hope very much that you'll come back to the others in the series and bring your friends as well. So I'm going to, without further ado, hand over to you, Roy, to the subject of Windows on the World.
Well, more specifically tonight, we're going to be talking about what the arts have to say about contemporary culture, and next week we'll be looking at science and technology a little bit more. On the 5th of January, 1953, a new play opened in Paris. It had been written by Samuel Beckett, an Irishman. Like many others in the literary avant-garde, he was living in France at the time. He preferred to live and work in France. And this was the first play he'd ever written in the French language. By any standards, it was an original work. As the curtains were raised, the lights are dim. It is evening on a country road, completely bare except for a spindly and apparently dead tree center stage. Two men, dressed as tramps, but wearing clownish bowler hats, talk in a fitful and disjointed fashion about everything and about nothing. They are waiting, we learn, to meet somebody. Somebody called Godot. While they pass the time, the two strangers appear, a pretentious landowner and his servant, whom he leads like a dog on the end of a rope. After a bizarre and mystifying conversation, master and servant depart, and a young boy enters to announce that Monsieur Godot will not come tonight, but surely will tomorrow. Night falls. The two tramps briefly contemplate suicide. Then they decide to leave. But as the curtain falls at the end of Act One, they do not move. Act Two repeats almost identically the same action, or lack of it. It is the next day, the same time, the same place, the two tramps are still waiting. Master and servant reappear, this time inexplicably blind and dumb, and again they depart, and again the young boy delivers essentially the same message. After an ineffectual attempt at suicide again, the two tramps prepare once more to leave the stage. But at the final curtain, they are left in exactly the same place they were at the beginning. Well, it is perhaps not surprising that the audience on that first night in 1953 grew restless. Some were baffled, some were irritated, and all were bored stiff. The play had no plot. It maundered ponderously on with no discernible dramatic development. True, there were comic moments, but the overall mood of the play was so depressing, it felt as if Beckett was cracking jokes at a funeral. Many judged the play pretentious, obscurity parading as profundity, one critic wrote. A misjudged attempt to exploit or perhaps to mock the intellectual snobs on the Parisian left bank, thought others. When John Gielgud, the second of the celebrated British actor, was shown the play, he dismissed it as, quote, a load of old rubbish. When an English translation was eventually staged at the Arts Theatre Club in London in 1955, Peter Bull, one of the actors, commented, I felt waves of hostility whirling toward me over the footlights. Mass exodus became a regular feature of every performance. Word quickly got around among the taxi drivers of London that the club was a place where you could pick up a few early fares, for at least half the audience had always left by the intermission. It was the same story in the USA, when Alan Schneider agreed to direct the play. Advance bookings were so disappointing, it was decided to open in Miami rather than New York, in the hope that wealthy holidaymakers in search of an evening's easy diversion would prove more willing to buy tickets than the aficionados of Broadway. But once again, by the beginning of the second act, almost everybody had left. Schneider may have gained some crumb of consolation at the final curtain, when he heard a solitary Tennessee Williams shouting bravo in the otherwise empty auditorium. But in spite of this catalogue of initial failure, Waiting for Godot was no flop. On the contrary, it has become one of the most widely discussed and influential literary landmarks of the 20th century and has been successfully revived, you may be aware, by Peter Hall at the Old Vic just at the moment. It's a seminal work in what the critic Martin Eslin has dubbed the theatre of the absurd. In Eslin's introduction to his book on that subject, published in 1962, he explains the reason for the play's significance. There can be no doubt, he writes, that for many intelligent and sensitive human beings, the world of the 20th century has lost its meaning. It has simply ceased to make sense. Previously held certainties have dissolved. The firmest foundations for hope and optimism have collapsed. Suddenly man sees himself faced with a universe that is both frightening and illogical. In a word, absurd. All assurances of hope, all explanations of ultimate meaning, have suddenly been unmasked as nonsensical illusions, empty chatter, whistling in the dark. Samuel Beckett, along with a number of other playwrights like Camus and Ionesco and Pinter, belong to this theatre of the absurd school, and they are articulating this essential meaninglessness in the nature of things, suggests Eslin. In its bizarre and bewildering ridiculousness, Waiting for Godot is an expression of the inescapable futility and uncertainty which Beckett feels lies at the very heart of our human condition. Significantly, in one of the notebooks, one of his own notebooks, Beckett reveals that he had for a while contemplated requiring the faint shadow of prison bars to be cast across the stage during the play. He later dismissed this idea as being too explicit. But that he considered such a device is illuminating, for the play is about bondage. Bondage to frustration and emptiness and futility. What are we on this planet for? That's the question that haunts Waiting for Godot. Whatever the theory of evolution says, you see, we human beings do differ from the animals in that we are not content merely to survive. We demand some context of meaning and purpose to make our existence significant. I had nothing to live for. That's what the man writes on the suicide note. I had nothing to live for. And Eslin, I think, rightly says, the problem for many people in our 20th century is that there is no answer to that question. Why? What's the point of it all? Alan Bennett, rather amusingly in Beyond the Fringe, says, life is like a tin of sardines, and we're all looking for the key. Beckett's dramatic metaphor, for that's what it really is, you see, in this sense, is brilliantly apt. Where are we going? What's the point of it all? We are like comic vagrants, he suggests, waiting for somebody we don't know who never seems to show up in any case. while the darkness of the night remorselessly closes in upon us. In commenting on his own play, Samuel Beckett says, life is an indefinite waiting for an explanation that never comes. Now, this same protest at the seeming meaninglessness of existence has coloured many forms of artistic expression in our century. Sir Thomas Beecham, some of you remember his name, an internationally famous conductor, he wrote his autobiography some years ago called A Mingled Chime. And in it he recounts the rather amusing tale of an occasion when, for the first time, he heard the opera Elektra by Richard Strauss performed. Now, those of you who know this work will be aware it contains some extremely dissonant, jarring passages. Beecham comments that conservative members of the audience clearly did not like this piece of music. He noted that one eminent British composer, whom he's too tactful to name, was particularly outraged, and on leaving the theatre was heard to mutter, "Words fail me. I'm going home at once to play the chord of C major 20 times to make sure it still exists." Now, I must confess actually to sharing that some sympathy with that, not over Elektra, but I remember going to a prom concert years ago as a student at the Royal Albert Hall and discovering that one of the pieces on the first part of the programme was one of those atonal pieces by Schoenberg. And I have to say it was an enormous relief to return after the interval to the more familiar tones of Brahms' First Symphony, I think it was, which if not in C major, is at least in C minor. To have our preconceptions about melody and harmony radically undermined, as many 20th century composers have sought to do, is a profoundly disturbing experience. But that, of course, is what such avant-garde composers intend. If there is one thing which contemporary music and literature and art all agree on, it is the desire to challenge our conventional understanding of the meaningfulness and the order of the universe. So someone like John Cage, for instance, selected his notes for his music by tossing coins, and Jackson Pollock dripped the paint on his canvas and rode bicycles over it. Extreme examples, I grant you, but both are using these bizarre techniques in order to eliminate every thought of design, of order from their work, because chaos and randomness are, in fact, they believe, the only authentic expression of truth. And the theatre of the absurd, and Beckett in particular, one more example of that. Now, not all the proponents of this rather pessimistic view of our world are as somber or as gloomy about it as Beckett seems to be in that play. Indeed, for many postmodern writers and thinkers, the whole idea of a world which is freed from some kind of given meaning, given truth, has been extraordinarily intoxicating. Perhaps it's the celebrated American philosopher Richard Rorty, who in more recent years has expressed this most clearly. He says, in tones of great enthusiasm, almost as an evangelist for this new way of looking at the world, "We do not discover truth. We human beings invent truth. That's what you must understand," he says. "There are no absolutes. There's no absolute truth. There are no absolute values. We invent truth. We invent values." He is therefore radically relativist, radically pluralist. All options are equally valid as far as he's concerned. The purpose of art, according to Rorty, is not to imitate or reflect some norms of beauty which are somehow given to us in the universe. The purpose of art is to define beauty, to invent beauty. And that's why artists in this postmodern mood break the boundaries, shatter our preconceived ideas. There are some, like Michel Foucault, the postmodern Frenchman who's written across a huge spectrum of different kinds of subjects. There are some like Michel Foucault who have taken this idea of inventing truth and inventing beauty and inventing values, as it were, as a personal creation so far. They've almost sought to make their own lives into a kind of work of modern art. In Foucault's case, this meant breaking every rule, breaking every boundary he possibly could, of course. He finished up his life, most of us would say tragically, but I don't think he would, dying of AIDS in 1984, having spent a substantial part of the 70s in the sadomasochistic gay scene of San Francisco. This kind of new mood, which is characteristic of our century, is having a huge effect trickling down, as it does, through from high culture to popular culture. One of the things I think, one of the consequences I think of it is that it makes us rather inept at handling death. For without any clear understanding or belief about ultimate meaning, death is something extremely disturbing. What the significance of the huge social response, popular response to the death of the Princess of Wales, Lady Diana, was, that people will go on talking about that for a long while. But I'm convinced personally that, in part at any rate, it was a manifestation of this inability of modern men and women to handle death, completely overcome with the tragedy of it. No context of meaning or hope in which to place their experience of having lost somebody they felt was important. I don't know if any of you remember the comedian Tony Hancock from my youth. I rather liked Tony Hancock, I have to say. In his final TV performance in Australia, he gave a rather ironic expression of why it is people feel so deaf to be such a very difficult subject these days. Let me try and at least in part emulate his Cockney accent. What have you achieved? What have you achieved? You lost your chance, me old son. You've contributed absolutely nothing to this life. Waste of time, you being here at all. No place for you in Westminster Abbey. The best you can expect is a few daffodils in a jam jar and a rough-hewn stone bearing the legend, "He came and he went." And in between, nothing. Nobody will even notice you're not here. Oh, about a year afterwards, somebody might say down at the pub, "Where's old Hancock? I haven't seen him around lately." "Oh, he's dead, you know." "Is he?" The right raison d'etre, that is. Now, death is one of the things that shows that our meaninglessness has got through to the roots of our culture. Another thing I think that shows it is a very widespread loss of sense of personal integration. At least that's how psychologists talk about it. People are talking these days about the de-centered self. Many psychologists are noting that the frequency with which they encounter narcissistic disorders, disorders in the integrity of the sense of self of individuals, and huge numbers of books have been written about it. It has also, of course, been reflected in the plays of our century. Harold Pinter, in particular, is preoccupied with the elusiveness of the true self. Here are some lines from a radio play entitled The Dwarves that was first performed back in the 60s, and puts his finger, I think, on the nub of the matter. One of the characters says this: "The point is, who are you? Not why or how, not even what, but who are you? Occasionally I believe I perceive a little of what you are, but that's pure accident." No, it's nothing like an accident. It's deliberate. It's a joint pretense. We depend on these contrived accidents in order to continue our relationship. But who are you really? How can I be certain of what I see? You are the sum of so many reflections. How many reflections? Whose reflections? Are reflections all you consist of? Well, Pinter, I think, is putting his finger on there, is that so much of the time we wear masks. Patterns of behaviour adopted so that we may fulfil a socially accepted role. The good father, the loving husband, the business leader, the trusty friend, and so forth, the sportsman, whatever. The repertoire can be vast. There are dozens of such masks.
Are any of them more authentically us? Who are we really amongst all these, this kaleidoscope of people, of roles that we play for other people? This is perhaps the deepest anxiety of many postmodern men and women, the doubt behind all doubt. One recalls Shakespeare's famous advice in Hamlet, this above all, to thine own self be true. But where is the true self to be found? That's the problem. All too often, the image we project is an artificial one. As I say, a role we play for the benefit of others. I remember one student in Cambridge some years ago expressing this to me very candidly. She said, when I go home in the vacation, I am the decent, respectable, virginal daughter my parents want me to be. And when I come up to college, I become a wild, dissipated, sexually permissive junkie. And she said, my problem is I don't know which is the real me. In perhaps less extreme ways, all of us worry about just who we are today. Woody Allen's film, Zelig, which you may have seen, is preoccupied with this same question. It features a chameleon-like individual who's constantly changing his personality as he appears in different social contexts. And I suppose on the pop scene, one thinks of Madonna, who has morphed, as it's called these days, reinvented herself numerous occasions. Who is she really? Which of all these various images and styles she wears is she? Or is she just the sum total of a whole plural range of different images? Spice Girls, we can say something similar about four plastic mannequins, each reflecting a different image, but who are they really? All this, it seems to me, is connected to this fundamental loss of meaning. Perhaps at the most grassroots elements of our culture, the bottom line of this loss of meaning lies with the Generation X community. Douglas Copeland in 1991 published the book of that title, in which he identified that youth culture at the end of the 20th century had some disturbing features. The children of the baby boomers were very different from their parents. They were affluent, they weren't poor, but they had very low motivation, many of them. They were content with low salary jobs at McDonald's. They spent all day long watching MTV or listening to music on their personal stereos. They drank heavily. They were characterized by what Durkheim in the 19th century called anomie, a kind of listless loss of any sense of the norm. Paul Simon, I think, was perhaps speaking for that generation when he wrote in one of his folk songs, on my wall my eyes can dimly see the pattern of my life and the puzzle that is me. From the moment of my birth till the instant of my death, there are patterns I must follow just as I must breathe each breath. Like a rat in a maze, the path before me lies, and the pattern never alters until the rat dies. Many in our Generation X feel that sense of entrapment, that sense of futility. Even those of us who perhaps would not be in McDonald-type jobs and McDonald-type environments all our lives, even as we should put on a facade of ambition and pretend to others and even to ourselves that we have purpose and ambition, even we, if the truth were known, have this nasty feeling deep down inside that when we reach midlife, it's all going to cave in on us. And of course, with quite a few people, when they reach midlife, it does. Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. That was a West End stage show some years ago. But unfortunately, of course, the world never does stop, does it? It bears us along, like passengers who boarded the wrong train. We find it moving so fast, we've no alternative but to stay on it till it reaches some unknown destination. But still, we feel like victims rather than masters of our destinies in it all. Like a rat in a maze, the path before me lies, and the pattern never alters till the rat one way, as I've already suggested, really, that Generation X tries to escape is through entertainments of one sort and another, escapist entertainments. The alcoholic haze, the drug-induced ecstasy, the latest fantasy movie, the latest soap opera, maybe the national lottery ticket. We have all sorts of ways of running away from the tedious reality of our rut into some fantasy world. Others simply lapse into apathy. It's an interesting word, apathy, because the Stoics, of course, the Stoic philosophers of ancient Greece coined the word apathia. For them, it expressed their grim determination not to allow feelings to jeopardize their personal inner tranquility. There was something courageous, even noble, about apathy, as the Stoics understood it, even if it did tend to make them stereotypically rather callous and frigid people. But for us today, apathy is not a virtue cultivated by disciplined mental effort. It's a state of lassitude born of disillusionment and utter indifference. If you go out onto the streets tonight into Victoria and talk to the average kids knocking around on the street, that is what you will find. That sort of apathy, lassitude and indifference. The Stoic said, "I won't be bothered. As an effort of will, I will not be bothered." The tragedy of modern people is they can't be bothered. 25 years ago, even, left-wing politics provided some young people with a sense of purposeful existence. But today, even that has evaporated. You know the famous piece of Paris graffiti? "To do is to be," Sartre. "To be is to do," Camus. "Dooby dooby doo," Frank Sinatra. Such is the cynicism of our day. The Greeks had a story in their mythology about the plant called the lotus. If anyone ate it, they forgot all their responsibilities, their home, their friends, their business. They only wanted to remain where they were and eat the lotus. More and more people of our generation seem to be joining the lotus eaters. One of the worries I have about virtual reality and the computer age, as I shall be saying next week, is that it rather panders to the desire to escape into some other world. "I couldn't care less" is the motto of many today, and it may even prove to be the epitaph of our culture. Arnold Toynbee, the historian, was one of the first people, I think, to use the word postmodern. In the 1940s, he surveyed 21 civilizations from the history of the world, and he believed he had discerned in all of them a pattern, the pattern of a downward spiral of decay. "Most civilizations," he says, "are not overrun by their enemies. They commit internal cultural suicide." And he identified three characteristics of that downward spiral. First, he said, abandon, a loss of belief in values. Second, he said, truancy, an escape into diversion and entertainment. And the third, he said, drift, by which he meant the loss of personal significance, this lost sense of real identity, who I am and what I'm here for. Toynbee believed that the postmodern phase would be the final phase of Western civilization. Yet to see whether he's right, but postmodernism is certainly here, not just in high culture of Samuel Beckett and composers like John Cage or painters like Jackson Pollock, not just among philosophers like Richard Rorty or rather extreme characters like Michel Foucault. It's with us at the grassroots of popular culture. It's expressed in pop music, it's expressed in the way our kids are living. A profound loss of meaning. Now, the question we want to ask, I guess, is why? Why is it that our generation is suffering from this sense of meaninglessness? Where does it come from? Many people trace it to the collapse of the Enlightenment, the European Enlightenment. During the 17th century, 18th century, the central intellectual movement in Europe was rationalism. Reason and science were believed to be omnicompetent. There was nothing they couldn't do. People believed that reason and science could really answer all the questions ultimately. It was only a matter of time. Huge confidence in the ability of the human mind to solve its problems. But in our century, people rightly observe, that confidence, that huge confidence in rationalism and science, has been greatly undermined. For one thing, science itself has proven to be very reductionist. It tends to interpret everything it sees in terms of random collisions of primary particles. Well, if all I am is a sort of complex of colliding random particles, what's the meaning in that? It seems as if I'm just chance and chaos at the bottom line. Secondly, science and technology in particular has proved to be unreliable, not worthy of the moral investment that was placed in it in the 19th century. Environmental disasters, pollution, nuclear accidents, and so forth. And thirdly, for those who know anything about it, even science itself seems less confident in reason than it used to be. It's talking now about the uncertainty principle and relativity. It no longer really seems to believe that it's engaging with some real world out there necessarily, only that it's inventing models to interpret experience. Many would trace the beginnings of Enlightenment rationalism to Descartes' Critique of Pure Reason, his philosophical work, which of course contains the famous lines, "I think, therefore I am." But what has happened, it seems, is that the thinking ego has not proven secure enough to provide a foundation for our human identity. If we are just chance collisions of primary particles, is there any reason to attribute any more reality to what's going on inside my brain now than to a schizophrenic hallucination or a bad nightmare? How do I distinguish those things, if all they are at the bottom of the day is chance collisions of particles? Well, as I say, this collapse of rationalism and of loss of confidence in science, that certainly has informed some of this loss of sense of meaning that we're talking about. But I want to suggest to you this evening that is not actually the most fundamental reason for it. The mistake had been made even before the Enlightenment. What really is responsible for this loss of personal meaning and significance in our 20th century is not a loss of confidence in reason, but a loss of confidence in God. The goddess Reason was herself a usurper. Go back 100 years before the Enlightenment, and you discover a time when people did feel they knew the meaning of the world and their own place in it. But it was very much a meaning which was tied to a Christian view of the universe. It is the loss of that which is the real seedbed out of which the existentialist and postmodernist despair of our late 20th century has emerged. One writer who identified this very early was Matthew Arnold, the poet. His poem, Dover Beach, was made famous by Don Cupid in a television series, The Sea of Faith, some years ago. In that poem, Dover Beach, Arnold pictures, whether he wrote it actually there or whether he was just writing it, imagining he was there, I don't know. But anyway, he pictures himself standing on Dover Beach, watching the tide as it recedes. And he sees in this receding tide a picture of the decline of the Christian faith in European culture. Let me read you a few lines. "The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world." He was writing in the middle of the 19th century, which, generally speaking, brimmed with humanistic confidence in the future. Religious scepticism was beginning to be fashionable amongst the intelligentsia in those days, but it was nothing to worry about, for science, which was eroding belief in God, would enable us human beings to become gods ourselves. Without supernatural aid, the evolutionary march of human civilization would create its own utopian destiny. That was the dream. Religious worldviews of earlier generations had been rendered redundant. At last, mankind had come of age. We could manage without God. As Arnold's younger contemporary, Nietzsche, was writing, God is dead. It remains only to exorcise his phantom shadow from the caves of human superstition in which he continues to lurk. It was beginning to become quite fashionable at the end of the 19th century to believe that belief in God was a cultural anachronism. The tide of faith had turned, as Arnold says. It was only a matter of time before Christianity passed into oblivion, like Greek mythology and medieval witchcraft before it. But interestingly, where others in his day were hailing the ebbing away of the sea of faith with a certain amount of glee and confidence, Matthew Arnold, in this poem, Dover Beach, glimpses the barrenness, as it were, of the naked shingle, which would be exposed with that erosion of faith. Let me read you the last verse. The world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain, and we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. I can't help feeling there's a certain prophetic insight in that allusion to ignorant armies clashing by night, for of course Arnold's suspicions about the failure of the humanist dream was confirmed by the devastating spectacle in the 20th century of two great wars. It is then, in my view, this loss of faith which has really been responsible for the loss of meaning which 20th century people feel. In fact, I wonder if Beckett wasn't quietly and in a punning way recognizing that himself by the name he gave to his mysterious stranger who never turned up, waiting for God. But unlike Beckett, I am less pessimistic than he was about the possibility of finding this mysterious God. Faith, I'm personally convinced, is much closer for many of us than we think. And that really is one of the themes I want to develop in these four talks. You know, the Bible insists that we human beings have an intuitive awareness of God. It insists that deep down at our deepest levels of personal honesty, we know enough about God to render us accountable to him, in fact. And I have to say, I am convinced that is true. I'm such a cynic, I'm doubtful of the sincerity of the skeptics. I saw a really nice poster on the wall of a student in Cambridge a little while ago, which is interesting, this connection. It says, Descartes, this great philosopher I've told you about, Descartes said, the only thing he was certain about was his doubts. One of the writers in the New Testament says, by faith we understand. It's interesting he should put it that way around. Not that reason informs faith, but that faith informs understanding. That without faith, we simply cannot make sense of ourselves or our world. I suspect that is true, and deep down all of us know it. One of the great heroes of philosophy at Cambridge was Wittgenstein, young, brilliant young man. And in his book Tractatus, I think he rather gives himself away on just this. There's a sentence in it that reads like this. The sense of the world must lie outside the world. Now, some of his admirers are embarrassed by that sentence. In fact, one of them has called it an adolescent lapse into mysticism. But when you think about it, it's self-evident truth. The sense of the world must lie outside the world. If there is meaning in our universe, and deep down I think we feel, we know there must be meaning, then that meaning cannot be within the universe, it has to be outside. If we don't believe there is some kind of ultimate truth, then we will never find any sense of meaning from within. That is the problem with postmodernism. Having rejected any idea of transcendence, of outsideness, it cannot make sense from within. All it has is a diversity of opinions and insights and feelings, but no way of evaluating them, no way of saying which is more valid than the other. Now the truth is, as Wittgenstein suggests, this universe is not self-explanatory. Its meaning must lie outside it. Scientific rationalism and materialism have proven intellectual dead ends for precisely this reason. That it is by faith we understand. If we do not proceed with a presupposition of faith, we will not come out with answers at the end, only with a larger cosmic question mark. An accidental universe thrown up by random chance with this monstrous anomaly we call a human being in the middle of it. No wonder our 20th century is populated by people, intelligent and otherwise, who are bewildered. Now, I want to suggest to you, in these closing moments, that it is possible the rationalist materialist worldview is seriously in error. I know my friends who call themselves scientific atheists like to pretend that rationalism and materialism have delivered modern men from the shackles of religious superstition. As the mathematician Laplace, or as he's reputed to have told Napoleon, "Sire, I have no need for the hypothesis of God." We have grown up, say my atheistic friends. We've come of age, we've passed beyond the infantile fairy tale of religion to the adult realities of science. We don't need mythological language about God any longer. Well, that's one explanation, of course, of why atheism has grown in the last 200 years. The advance of science has pushed it out. But there is an alternative explanation for atheism having grown, and that is this: that technocratic, urbanized culture has atrophied a faculty of spiritual perception which is really natural to us. So that increasingly modern men and women are incapable, without a great deal of deconditioning, of seeing something which was as plain as a pikestaff to our ancestors and is still glaringly obvious to the larger part of the world's population. Namely, that this world is not self-explanatory, somebody made it, and us included. Is it not possible that religious consciousness, which after all is one of the things which defines human beings. Now, the highest apes are without religious consciousness, and the most primitive of mankind possess it. It's one of the most distinguishing characteristics of the human race, religious consciousness. Is it not arguable then that modern atheism, far from being a step forward in human progress, is actually a repression, a tragic retrogression behind the condition of even our primeval infancy? Could it be that rationalism has performed a kind of psychic lobotomy, a kind of piece of surgery on our spiritual optic nerve, which has severed our ability, as I say, to see what actually is glaringly obvious, that you cannot make sense of this world or of your own life unless you begin with faith. Faith in a creator God. See, if that is correct, if it is only by faith that we can understand, then it is surely to be expected that without faith, understanding will elude us. And that, I suggest to you, is exactly the fate of modern Western men and women at the end of the 20th century. Far from emancipating us from superstition, we have been plunged by our science and by our rationalism into an unprecedented abyss of meaninglessness and nihilism and despair. And all that the postmodernists are doing is either reflecting that despair or finding some kind of way of coping with it. I came across the most remarkable article in the Daily Telegraph a year or two back. Struck my eye because it was written by Professor Anthony O'Hare, Professor of Philosophy at Bradford, who's the author of a rather popular introduction to philosophy that I have on my bookshelf, and I know him to be an agnostic. That's why I was very interested in the title he gave his article. It's called Religion Has Its Role in Understanding. Let me just read you some of it. He says, I practice no religion. I am not a religious believer. Nonetheless, if religion were true, it would be the most important truth of all. Even from my agnostic standpoint, the religious question remains the most important one each of us has to face. In the absence of religion, he says, society runs the risk of diminishing human life and value because it sees human consciousness as simply froth on a blind evolutionary process. He goes on, Nietzsche believed that the death of God would be followed by a pandemonium of free spirits. Actually, it has been followed by a malaise of meaninglessness. A materialism in which human activity seems little more than a quest for momentary satisfaction. It is religion that puts such materialistic explanations into question. It personally confronts the individual with the highest understanding of what it means to be human. That he or she is a child of God. Somebody who may be a temple of the Holy Spirit. That sin is real. And redemption is possible. I say, I found it a most astonishing article. It reminded me rather of Voltaire's desperate admission. If God didn't exist, it would be necessary to invent him. Or of Jean-Paul Sartre's tragic cri de coeur, that God does not exist, I cannot doubt. That my whole being cries out for God, I cannot deny. Oh, here you see in that article is candidly admitting that the materialistic framework which scientific humanism adopted for its understanding of us human beings doesn't do justice to who we are. Well, I want to suggest to you we do not have to surrender to O'Hare's agnosticism on this issue. Faith is not intractably elusive, as he seems to want to suggest. There are plenty of intelligent, thoughtful men and women in our day whose lives have been revolutionized by the discovery that faith can give understanding. It can provide a context of meaning for their lives, which rings true in a very fundamental and satisfying and inescapable way. We should be saying more about that in subsequent talks.